From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Ruth Reichel had one family ritual growing up, dinner at Lou Chow's on 14th Street in New York, where over the years, she and her father would sample every dish on the menu, and her mother never ordered anything but a German apple pancake. Reichel's interest in food sent her on a trajectory that bloggers and Instagram influencers can only dream of.
When they came to me and said, we're looking for a new editor-in-chief for Gourmet and we think it should be you, I looked at them and said, I think you're crazy.
Reichel eventually took the plum job as editor-in-chief at Gourmet. She documents her 10 years at the magazine in a new memoir called Save Me the Plums. Hi.
Hi.
Your gourmet story begins with nostalgic recollections of a 1946 issue of Gourmet that features this leaping swordfish on the cover and the compelling piece, Night of Lobster, inside. Could you share with us how food and that particular magazine played a role in your childhood imagination?
Well, I was in with my father in a used bookstore. I was eight, and he brought me a pile of old magazines, which he did regularly. But on this particular occasion, there was this issue of Gourmet, and this picture kind of captured my imagination, and I opened it up, and it was just sheer luck that it happened to be a piece written by an extraordinary writer who was actually a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet from Maine. And he wrote this very evocative story about rowing out to get the lobsters out of the pots with some friends on this starry night and building a huge bonfire. And his description of eating the lobsters, they're very hot and they joggle them from hand to hand to cool them off and they twist them off and then they lie down and they watch the stars overhead and then at the end they paddle home. And it was like a child's fantasy story to me. And it was the first time that I realized that nonfiction could be as wonderful as fiction. It sort of opened up food to me in a new way where, for me, it became a magic door into sensory experiences. And I realized from this piece that if you paid attention to food, your whole world could expand. And I became fascinated by the magazine. So after that, whenever we went out, my father would find me some old gourmets, and eventually he bought me a subscription to the magazine. And it really changed my life. I mean, it gave me this focus on food. And for me, it was much bigger than just food, though. It was really a way of looking at the world. I have to say that I never, ever thought that it would actually be something that I would work at. I mean, it never occurred to me that I could be a food writer. It was just this pure pleasure for me.
The lobster is just such an interesting through line in Gourmet. I know that my own experience of the older issues of the magazine that happened before I became conscious, let's say, there were so many lobsters on covers that were photographed in such particular, opulent, and odd ways that I almost feel like if you could collect every lobster image, it would just show every decade, like a window into how every decade was viewed.
Well, it's true. And I mean, it's really interesting that, I mean, even in my book, lobster becomes something of a theme. But in those days, in the original days, lobster was a sign of luxury. So it was a very obvious cover choice for Gourmet because only rich people ate lobsters. You know, it was like, you know, if you were a fancy French restaurant, if you wanted to have 3 stars, I mean, you served lobsters, you served caviar, you served foie gras. They were kind of, you know, the bottom line of luxury. Down the road, unbeknownst to me, lobster would become a hallmark of the new gourmet through David Foster Wallace's piece, Consider the Lobster.
When you were offered the job, you were at the New York Times where you were the restaurant critic. Being a restaurant critic, the dailiness of the eating and the turnaround of the reviews are so different than the the length of time that you're working on a magazine before it actually comes out and becomes something physical. So could you talk about the transition from newspaper to magazine and how that proffer was originated to you in a way that made you actually jump?
Well, I knew nothing about how a magazine was put together. I mean, I'm a newspaper writer. You know, I write it today, it's in print tomorrow, and then they throw it away the next day. And magazines are very different. I mean, what I didn't know at that time was that food magazines are even more different because at Gourmet, we shot everything a year ahead of time because we shot in season. So you can't shoot a Thanksgiving spread in the middle of summer. You can't get the ingredients. It doesn't look right. The landscape's wrong. So we literally worked for the food shoots a full year ahead, which couldn't be more different than what you do in a newspaper. On top of that, I mean, I was a writer. I wasn't a manager. And being a manager seemed daunting to me. You know, tell 65 people what to do. I can barely figure out what to do myself. Then Cy just kept saying, you know, we really want this to be the best Epicurean magazine, and we think you're the one. Now, unbeknownst to me, I had in the mid-80s with Laurie Ochoa and Jonathan Gold taken over the food section of the LA Times. And to my great surprise, it turns out that Cy knew about that and knew that we had won a lot of awards and that we had done a food section that was very different than what was currently being done. And he sort of used that as a model and said, don't you want to be able to expand on that? And what you did was fantastic. And come do a better, deeper, more expensive version of that at Gourmet. And ultimately, it was irresistible. And I have to say, I also said, you know, I will do it if Laurie and Jonathan will come with me and do it.
And did it take them very long to decide to go along?
Not really. We had worked together and had such great fun working together for a long time. And I think the idea of moving to New York for a while was thrilling to them. I just kept saying, please, 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 and they came.
So you arrive at this place. The culture couldn't be more, I mean, you had already been in New York for a while, so you were used to the way of luxury dining. You were used to being in an environment in which a great deal of what we now call one percenters live. But the luxury that surrounds a Cy Newhouse publication must have been so different, just the culture.
Everything was different. I'm a journalist. My husband is a journalist. We never made very much money. We were strictly subway people. Living in New York on journalist salaries was really difficult. We certainly did not know about the kind of life that they offered us at Condé Nast. And I mean, the truth is that I didn't even know about it when I accepted the job. It was a real shock to me that the job came with an enormous salary, with a driver, with a clothing allowance. And I'd never had much of an office. I mean, that my office at the LA Times was a repurposed broom closet. You know, suddenly I had this giant office that was most of a New York City block with a private bathroom and, you know, hair and makeup people showing up all the time. And it was astonishing to me that people lived like that. And for the longest time, I kept saying, you know, I'm just a visitor in this land. I am not going to get used to this because it is going to go away. I never, ever thought that I would spend the rest of my life at Condé Nast. And that's a good thing I didn't think then.
The test kitchen at Gourmet was legendary. The chapter where you go there for the first time and you start to meet the characters that are going to become your employees is so fascinating and strange, this world. Could you take us through one of the more epic recipe testing processes, maybe the Sloppy Joe saga?
Okay, so the Sloppy Joe saga. Let me first say that what was surprising to me was I had, you know, been reading for years, you know, shot in Gourmet studios, and I had known about this amazing testing process that they had. And it was amazing. What I didn't know was what a wonderful place the gourmet test kitchens were. That, I mean, there was this kind of family of cooks and kind of camaraderie and competition. But it, especially in the old building, which was much smaller than what we ultimately had at Four Times Square, but, you know, it was like a big, cozy kitchen with a lot of people cooking together. But the testing process was literally to absurdity. So a cook would be given an assignment. Okay, so the Sloppy Joes was for our movie issue, and we decided we were going to do something that people could sit in front of the TV and eat. And the cook who was assigned to it, you know, went off and did a lot of research and then came back and said, I'm thinking Sloppy Joes, maybe on biscuits and with a salad. And the art director said, no, salad's not good. It's too messy. You can't put it all on one plate. Think of something else. So she said, well, maybe with green beans. When a new recipe was done, the cook would shout, taste, and everybody would come galloping towards it with their forks, and everybody would attack it and then start saying, there's too much salt, it needs more cumin, you should try this, you should try that. And so everybody gave their flavor comments on the first version of the Sloppy Joes. And then the art director said, but you know, it's too dark. It's not going to photograph well. Could you try it with turkey? So the next one is with turkey. And then he doesn't like the shape of it. And so it gets done again and the bowls get changed. And then she's doing the biscuits. And in addition to changing the recipe and saying, let's put some cheese in there. Maybe you should alter it, not just cheddar, throw some Parmesan in, bake it more. And it goes on and on and on. And then Richard, the creative director, says, you know, it really needs some color in there. Could you throw some chives in there? And this goes on through 20 iterations or so until we're convinced that it's as good as it can get, at which point it is given to a cross-tester, another cook who does it all over to make sure that they can get exactly the same result. And if not, it starts all over again. And then it goes into, and which I haven't even gone into the book, it goes into the recipe writing process, which is equally arduous. The amount of energy that went into each of these recipes is one of the reasons why gourmet was so revered, because those recipes really worked.
During the period of time that you were there, you really took it from a place that was really past, and you brought it into the new world of food, in which there are a lot of things that are discussed besides deliciousness and the beauty of the place from a purely surface point of view. Could you talk about how that played out in maybe the first cover that ended up being published under your watch?
It was kind of extraordinary, because when I got to Gourmet, it turns out that the staff had never had a meeting. And so the first thing I did was call a meeting and say, you know, here are these, you know, extraordinarily passionate and knowledgeable food people. And I said, what do you think we should do? And it wasn't just me. It was all of them saying, the American food landscape has really changed. And we really want to talk about what's happening on the farms. We want to talk about the way food is not the same as it used to be. We want to talk about what's happening in animal confinement facilities. What are the issues with genetic modification? Let's get someone to talk about what's good about it and someone else to talk about what's bad about it. In that very first meeting, we talked about doing a produce issue. You know, one of the editors said, you know, Gourmet has never really gone back to the land, and isn't it time that we did that? And let's, you know, go into a whole issue focused on farmers. It was, for me, so exciting to be surrounded by this group of like-minded people who were equally passionate about the notion that food was changing in America in ways that were both good and bad, and that one of the things that we should be doing was giving the people who cook, you know, information that they could really use. I started saying to them, you know, what are your, who are your favorite writers? Let's get great writers in here to write delicious, wonder. I mean, I kept thinking of Night of Lobster, and let's get more stories like that that will open up people's imaginations. So everybody went off and, you know, called their favorite writers. And we got, you know, in that very first issue, we got, you know, wonderful writers and a whole, you know, kinds of articles that the magazine had never done before. I mean, one of the things that was amazing to me is that Kempe, who was the deputy food editor, said, we have trouble in the kitchen with teaspoons. Let's get every teaspoon we can find on the market and see how similar they are. Let's weigh everything. And it turned out that there was no law about, there is no law, about what a teaspoon should actually be, and that they were wildly different. You know, we got like 30 different teaspoons and we got 30 different weights. So, I mean, we were just sort of thinking as much as we could about how can we make a magazine that we want to read.
And what was that first cover for you?
The first cover for me was, I have been carrying around for years a photograph by the great photographer W. Eugene Smith, which is a black and white photograph of a beautiful French peasant woman standing in a field with her cupped hands holding out what are probably truffles, you can't really tell, with this beautiful smile on her face saying, you can imagine her saying, look what I found for you, here are the treasures of the earth. And I gave it to my art director and said, you know, can you do a version of this? Well, the version wasn't exactly what I had in mind. That was the feeling I wanted, was, look, here's something wonderful we're going to give you.
There is so much to talk about in this book. It's quite wonderful. Talk to me about the title, Save Me the Plums.
There is a wonderful poem called This Is Just to Say by William Carlos Williams, where he leaves a note on the refrigerator saying, I have eaten the plums that were in the refrigerator, which you were probably saving for breakfast. Forgive me. They were so cold and so sweet. And I've always loved that poem. William Carlos Williams, in many ways, embodies what I wanted the magazine to be, because he was a doctor who did a lot of work with poor people. He seems like he was like a really wonderful man who was also an extraordinary writer and poet and was friends with Hemingway and Ezra Pound. So he sort of was the America I wanted Gourmet to be, an America that was both practical and ethical and poetic. That was my vision for the magazine. And it was a plum job. And I got this plum job. It seemed perfect to me.
Well, thank you so much, Ruth.
Thank you. I've loved this.
Ruth Reichel's memoir, Save Me the Plums, was released by Penguin Random House earlier this month. After a short break, we get a pitch for Japanese convenience store sandwiches in Echo Park. Stay with us.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We are back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Once again, Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic for the LA Times, joins us. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we going?
Today, we're headed to Echo Park to a small cafe called Conby. I don't know if you've heard of it.
It's probably the most Instagrammed restaurant ever since it opened. A genius sandwich shop.
Yes, a genius sandwich shop. One of the things that makes Conby so interesting to me, it's a tiny 10-seat cafe run by two young, energetic chefs, Akira Akuto and Nick Montgomery. And they came up together. They're both alumni of Momofuku in New York. And I think they've been longtime friends, and you would expect them to do something interesting together, and they have. It's a sandwich shop that really looks to exalt the Japanese convenience store sandwich of all things. What is surprising about Kanbi is that they do so much with such a tiny space. You sit at the counter, you can see the process of the sandwiches being made in front of you, and everything looks really, really simple, but everything has like 10 steps behind it.
Talk about the eggplant sandwich, because that in particular really seems to show the care and attention.
So they deep fry the eggplant. It's panko breaded. You know, a lot of times when you get eggplant, you get like a kind of an oily, unctuous result if it's not done right. And this one's very crisp, which is not a word you use much to describe eggplant. It has a really great savory quality. And the savoriness is really amplified by the use of what's called bulldog sauce, which is a really popular Japanese condiment. I describe it as kind of a cross between A1 steak sauce and Worcestershire. It's got kind of like that sweet, savory, umami thing going on.
Did you have to wait a long time?
I think you always have to wait when you go to Kanbi. Even going like on a Tuesday or Wednesday, I think I waited like 20 minutes. And it's a small space, so you're kind of crowded by the door. I would say service is really good, though. I think Kanbi has gotten a reputation as being kind of a hipster Echo Park outpost. It's a very friendly spot, though. And then they also have a quick service window that serves the entire menu. So if you don't feel like waiting around for one of those coveted stools at the bar, you can put an order in at the window and, you know, take your sandwich to go.
So one of the interesting parts of your piece has to do with something that you didn't even write, which is at the very bottom of the review where the address is given and all the information. It says, details, credit and debit cards only, no cash accepted. So there seemed to be a Twitter uprising about this.
Yeah, that's a great point. I've seen a lot of discussion around this, and I think it's something worth talking about. What does it mean to be a cash-free establishment? I've seen people make the argument that, you know, it cuts off a large segment of people who don't have a debit card, don't have a credit card. Is there a classist element at work here? And then you can also look at it from the restaurateur's point of view. It's, I'm sure, a lot more streamlined to run an operation, especially when you're working in such a small space where you could just kind of swipe a card. So it's definitely something that I think has become, I won't say a talking point, but kind of a point of discussion when it comes to places like Kanbi.
So I know that the egg sandwich is a darling on Instagram because of that jammy, beautiful yolk in the center of the sandwich. But the pork, I think, was the one that first got a lot of attention from people who had spent a lot of time in Japan.
Yeah, I think the pork sandwich at Kanbi is really a good example of what you can do with panko breading. It's just got a really beautiful, spiky breading, so it gives you this really satisfying crunch. But then you've also got a really succulent, at the heart of it, it's a succulent pork sandwich. That contrast is really satisfying. It's what makes so many of these Kanbi sandwiches, I think, successful.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
That's LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. Find a link to the LA Times review she wrote about Kanbi on our website. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood. In a minute, we return to one of my favorite subjects, pie. Don't go anywhere. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. Ask Los Angeles pastry chef Isa Fabro to describe her Mango Royale icebox pie, and she'll tell you it's part American and part Filipino, just like she is. In anticipation of this year's pie contest, Fabro joins us to talk about her heralded no-bake dessert. So I'm already trying to imagine what category it would be.
Oh, boy.
So it would be cream pie.
Yeah, but it's also fruit, and it's also a cold, frozen icebox.
Wow.
So
not a recommended pie, actually, to bring to the contest.
Unless you have a...
We'll just eat it on the side.
Yeah. palate cleanser.
So I understand that it's a version of a popular Filipino dessert.
Yeah, the popular Filipino dessert originally was the crema de fruta. So that is either a sponge cake or a lady finger kind of layered dessert with cream and originally using a fruit cocktail.
I love fruit cocktail.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you can imagine, it looks really homey. And the mango real from that, it's instead the graham crackers, the whip, and of course the Manila mangoes.
So the graham crackers would be in that original crema de fruta?
In the original crema de fruta, it's more like, I think, any kind of common cookie. So at the time, either sponge cake or lady fingers.
And so the whip you're referring to is not the product Cool Whip, is it?
I do it with what I call condensed milk whip. So what I'll do is I have a ratio of the heavy cream, or also heavy whipping cream, and the condensed milk. If I'm making one pie, I'll do it by hand, but I'm making more than one pie at a time. But I'm still using just kind of a gradual medium whisk on that machine, and that's just to really help build the strength of that whip so that when I pipe it, it has that structure of the sugar and the air and the fat molecules, like building a really nice, strong foundation because it is a layered pie.
Do you add more sugar to the sugar that's already in the condensed milk?
I do not.
And do you add any flavorings?
I do not add any flavorings. I've found that the way that I ripen the mangoes, it's an over-ripening process so that when the dessert becomes chilled, that really beautiful flavor comes through that coldness.
So let's talk about the mango. We're lucky here. We get several different varieties in Southern California. You said a Manila mango. Is that the Alfonso?
It's the Atulfo or the Champagne mango. So think of it like a bright yellow-orange kind of teardrop-shaped mango.
Littler.
I'm kind of cupping my hands like, please, sir, I want some more. Like, this is the size of the mango. Not the bigger ones. If you're thinking of the Kent or the Kite, those kind of look like red and green ox hearts.
Bulky. Just,
yeah, really big. I have tried to use those for this dessert. They don't really work as well. It's a very different taste. They're more on the juice side, less fruit.
How do you keep the mangoes still in good quality as you're aging them?
This is a funny story because I have different places where I go buy the mangoes. And there was a period where I had so many orders for this dessert because it is my most requested dessert. And I realized I had all of these mangoes, but they were not ripe. So I was trying to figure out, what do I do to ripen these mangoes? And I'm like, okay, I'm going to put them in my car.
Oh, that's so really smart.
I put them in my car. And when I buy the mangoes, I'm buying them in flats of either 12 or 14. So I had them in my car and I put tea towels over them. And it was like a little science experiment, you know, kind of like checking them each day. You know, the car smelled amazing. I was just like this.
Did you turn them?
I didn't have to turn them. So then after about 2 weeks, they end up looking wrinkled. And sometimes there are some brown spots, but those brown spots don't necessarily mean that the fruit underneath the skin is bruised.
Now I'm so curious about what people do with their cars in terms of fruit and food storage. The beauty of this dessert is really that there's very limited baking involved, or almost none, right?
The only cooking that you do with this is really getting the butter browned.
And is that for the crust?
That is for mixing in with the graham crumbs. I call it brown butter, but it's really a brunoisette. So you'll see those particles of like that really dark, all of those butter solids, very caramelized. And you pour that butter into the crumbs, and you really want to just get as much of those dark bits as possible into the crumbs and incorporating those really well all together.
Yum. If someone were to use this spectacular sounding pie as inspiration for a pie that they would want to enter,
oh boy,
would making a cream pie be the best way to incorporate these flavors?
I would actually say you would probably have to par-bake that crumble crust, and it would be better as a custard. Make some kind of fruit curd out of the mango, just because that kind of pie will not stand the time that it takes for everybody to taste and judge that pie.
Let's talk about that for a minute, because this is something that happens every year at the pie contest, where people come pretty early in the day and drop off their pies, and then the pies hang out until they're ready to be judged. Mm. It's good to stabilize cream and to cook cream.
Your pie is going to be sitting out for a little bit. So if it's meant to be served cold, it will not be cold. You know, if you have a meat pie, you better make sure it tastes just as good room temperature versus hot. Meringues, oh boy, that's a whole other thing. Although I have seen pies looked amazing. The last year pie, the one that won,
was incredible.
I thought, how did they, what did they put in this?
I really need to take a meringue lesson from her, because I'm such a bad meringue maker.
It looked, there was no weeping, and I thought, okay, I did not enter this contest, and thank God I never have to.
You know, every year I always think, maybe I'll enter anonymously, and then I'll just hear all the stuff the judges say about my effort. How do you account for the popularity of Filipino desserts in Southern California right now?
There's a baking tradition with Filipino cuisine. Desserts and sweets are not only for after dinner or after meals. It's really about the idea of merienda and eating something throughout the day, whether it's savory or sweet. So it could be a sweet roll. It could be, you know, a hollow hollow. It could be a slice of cake as a little snack. It's not a meal, because a meal is served with rice. And then also that sweet and that savory together, where, okay, I'm going to have an empanada, and then I'm going to have some leche flan. There are no rules.
I'm very excited to have a little break from recording here and
I'm excited to slice up that pie, because I brought one. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Isa.
Thank you, Evan.
That's LA pastry chef Isa Fabro. Once again this year, she'll be a judge at our pie contest at UCLA on Sunday, April 28th. Have you registered yet? Inquiring minds, Paco, want to know. And now it's time for the Market Report. Let's see what Laura Avery is shopping for this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I am standing here talking to, I'm going to say, the guy who really kicked off the whole cocktail chef movement, craze, whatever you want to call it here in LA. This is Matt Biancanello, and you just have the most uncanny ability to look at any piece of produce in the market and instantly create an amazing cocktail. And here we are today, and we're looking at a bunch of stuff you're working on. You are constantly developing recipes. It's almost like you can't stop the flow. You can't stop it. So let's talk about what this setup is.
Yeah, so what I want to do, I know you're coming to an end here, and it's like the second or last week of your market report. So what I did bring to you is I brought, one of the things that happened in the last year is I started making beers from scratch with no hops or grains, so wild herbs from the mountains. And then whatever. So you have a passion fruit beer here that we made from scratch, and then also a passion fruit kumquat liqueur. Not very sweet, sweetened with buckwheat honey. So I want you to just sample on those. But what I'm also doing is stinging nettles are kind of, we've got the last month of those, and Floribella has amazing stinging nettles, especially because of where they are in the Sierras and the water and the mountains and the rain and the quality of water that's going to their produce is amazing. So I just have a very simple thing. I decided this year, too, to put stinging nettles into rum. So I have a Kahlua rum, which is an amazing rum made in Kauai. But
Kahlua rum?
No, it's a Kahlua rum, but it's made in Kauai. But it's with stinging nettles, that, and I also juiced fresh asparagus.
See, right there, no one would have put stinging nettles with Kahlua rum, except you.
Well, I think they would be shocked, yes, because they don't even have stinging nettles in Hawaii, because I tried.
You put it
on? Yeah, I tried.
Okay, you put it all together.
And then we've got these amazing peach blossoms, all these blossoms that are happening on right now as a beautiful garnish. I'm still trying to work these into some kind of bite, but they're a beautiful garnish, so that's what I'm going to work on.
Right. All right, so
what you can do is you guys can sip on your beer and your liqueur while I finish making this cocktail, and then you can ask me whatever you want.
Okay.
But I'm so happy to be here. I'm so sad to see you go. You are the unicorn of unicorns when it comes to the farmer's market. So how do they like the beer?
It was delicious. The 1 ounce, everybody, the 1 ounce that I drank was delicious.
So she says. So that's really simple, because that's taking a beer that I really learned just from Pascal Boudère, the forager, and he would make all these beers. And I said, like, you know what? I really want to fuse things from the market and do this. I feel like there's a lot. And it's just, so what happened was it just became another medium for me to explore, which is what I love. I know you like bourbon and you like those straight things, but this is really, really herbal. I love the flavor of the stinging nettle. And then when you juice something like an asparagus, it just has a nice froth on the top. And I just want to put a couple of these beautiful peach blossoms and then you can go.
Okay. So there is some of the asparagus juice in there along with the nettles. Okay.
And what's nice about it is like you can see how green the color is.
Well, there's dark green. There's pale green all the way through, dark green foam on top, and then these little adorable pink peach blossoms floating on top of that. This is like you just want to kind of frame it and put it on the wall. But it is a beverage, so I am going to take a sip.
This kind of drink would be perfect with food.
So the first thing you do is you smell the asparagus as it's coming up to your nose, and then the liquor itself, the bottom half, you know, the stinging nettle part, there's no stinging involved at all, but it's a very earthy, mild, pleasing, pleasant flavor.
Yeah,
it's delicious.
I love nettles. I love them. I love everything about nettles, and I love the flavor of it.
Yeah, and I think they just grow wild in a lot of places.
They grow wild, and it also is the heart of biodynamic farming, if you want to talk about biodynamic farming. That's the main thing that these farms are using in their soil. Absolutely, because they grow. So the whole concept is you're not using any fertilizers. Even fertilizers that are organic can add a lot of too much nitrogen to the soil. But when you deal with biodynamic and you're dealing with the soils and the compost, nettles is such a huge part of that.
Huh.
So it has been something that a lot of farms let go now. And now they're bringing it to the markets all the time. So people making pastas with them, all kinds of things. But to me, people don't even realize it has higher kind of protein than kale. It's more of a superfood than kale.
Really?
And people use it as a tea. I love to just make this as a tea. Mm-hmm. It's really good for inflammation.
Oh, they sting.
They sting, and I let them sting me.
You do?
I'm one of those people. Yeah, I'm one of those people. It's a little strange where I like the sensation of that. I think it's sometimes nice to wake yourself up. But it's not that bad. It's not like you've got jellyfish stinging you. No.
Yeah.
But you know what's interesting is when you start foraging, you start seeing the leaves different sizes, the larger nettle leaves will last for 10, 15 minutes, where these will dissipate, you know, in 30 seconds.
Oh.
But for some reason, like the big leaves, it's like you keep, it's almost like you got a rash or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah.
So I learned that the hard way. Yeah.
Well, so you do not harvest with gloves. You just go out there and just pick them up in your bare hands?
Absolutely. But I prefer getting the nettles at the farmer's market because I know that the water, the soil, and everything, it's just, it's not that this is not clean. It's just that I like to be in more remote places for nettles. It's just how it is, because it's something I'm actually going to eat.
Right.
And not just in alcohol.
Again, not to give away your whole creative process, but how do you put things together?
For me, because I was never trained, and I talk about this a lot, I don't think about right or wrong. So it's all about, oh, I have this in front of me, let me juice it, or let me try it, let me put it in. And it always starts very, very simply, because I had no education. When I had to latch onto something, I learned about the daiquiri. And I was like, okay, what is a daiquiri? Well, a daiquiri was created in Cuba in the 30s. And what's in it? Rum, lime, and sugar. And then all of a sudden, I thought, wait a second. If I take out the rum and put gin, it's a gimlet. If I take out the rum and put tequila, it's a margarita. If I put in mint, it's a mojito. So for a long time, my formula was just based on that.
Yeah.
But my creativity came from, what am I going to infuse in that? What am I going to make? What am I going to... And that's where I feel like that's what doesn't stop. So the whole thing that was great about the library bar is I didn't have a menu. They didn't care because the sales were great and I was getting a lot of press. So think about the muscle that I developed during that time of just off the fly, off the fly. I loved making sure that every drink was almost custom for everybody.
You did. I remember I came there once and I said I want to have something made based with bourbon. And then you just, from there, you just created a cocktail with all those herbs you had on the counter.
Know,
it looks
I
like you're
those.
Going in a forest, your
you
whole bar.
See me.
You couldn't even see you. And you would just use that stuff on the counter. Nobody was doing that.
I loved it. You know, it's the greatest memories.
That was Matt Biancanello. He is on the scene at the Farmer's Market weekly. He's also up in the hills foraging, and now he's back at the Roosevelt Hotel at the library bar, the bar he sort of put on the map with his creative cocktail culinary skills. And couldn't be happier to see you, and look forward to seeing you every week. I'm talking now with Dawn Birch from Florabella Farm. As Matt mentioned, right there at the foothill of Sequoia National Park in Three Rivers. And Dawn grows a wide variety of organic produce, greens, on a beautiful little flat area next to where the rivers come out of the mountains. And you grow stinging nettles. Is that something you grow, or were they just there and you decided to bring them to the market?
We don't actually plant them or grow them. They grow wild all over the farm on the sides of the fields, and we just simply harvest them.
And how long have you been doing that? I mean, when did you start thinking about bringing them to the market?
Well, I think it all started maybe 12 years ago when my husband got up one morning and there was a whole bunch of people in our fields that didn't work there. And he said to our head man, "Who are these people?" And he said, "Don't worry, they're going to pull all your weeds, they're going to put them in bags and take them away." And James said, "I can't pay them." He said, "They don't want to get paid." And James said, "Okay, what's going on?" And that's when we realized we have several wild weeds that are highly nutritious and delicious. And we started bringing them, and one of them is the stinging nettle.
Okay, and so 12 years ago, you started bringing them in, and people would look at them, and you'd say, "Don't touch them because they sting." What was your sales pitch?
I always told people that it's one of the healthiest greens on the planet. It is. It's considered a super green, and I read about it, and I did it myself. If they have arthritic parts, they should actually intentionally sting their arthritic parts with the stinging nettle. It's the equivalent of many bee stings, and the blood flows to the area and kind of blows out the joints, and I've found it real effective for me. I make a tea with it, and I was informed recently that you have to cold steep the tea because if you heat it, you lose the medicinal properties.
And do you drink that yourself?
Oh, yes.
You do?
Yes, every season.
Okay, now we got to talk about the season. So they're weeds, they're wild, but they do have a season?
The stinging nettles are here when the rain is here. So however long the rainy season lasts, that's how long we have the stinging nettles.
So we really kind of have to look out for them.
In many ways.
I mean, wait for them to come back.
Keep your eyes open for them and look out for them when you see them in the market. Don't grab them and don't shove them in your mouth.
Well, Dawn, this is great. It's sad that we're just now getting to know about this toward the end of the season, but with everything here at the market, we're seasonal, and we can start looking forward to something next season as soon as it goes out.
Exactly right. As soon as one thing's gone, a new thing comes in.
That was Dawn Birch. She is co-owner of Florabella Farm up in Three Rivers. It's a beautiful farm nestled right up against the foothills of Sequoia National Park and coexisting with nature and bringing in delicious organic produce. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
And now a very specific listicle that's arrived just in time for Passover. That's after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Gore Vidal, not a Jew, once wrote, "There's no ish about it. Either you're a Jew or you're not." As we start to think about what to arrange on our Seder plates for Passover, we called Tablet Magazine Editor-in-Chief Alana Newhouse. She joins us to discuss the traditional favorites and questionable contenders that made it into her book, The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list. Hi.
Hi.
So I have to tell you that as a secular Jew, I know how important food is for knitting me to my tradition. But reading through the entire 100, it was staggering to me how many of them, like almost all of them, I'd say maybe 90, were so interwoven in my childhood.
It's great to hear. I think you're not alone.
So let's begin with the one thing on the list that probably everybody can agree on, matzah.
Yes.
Why is no Jewish food more important?
The story of humans, as Jews understand it and as Jews tell it, has food interwoven into it. Obviously, the story of the human drama begins with and turns on an apple. But food is an integral part of the narrative of the Bible. And perhaps at no point is that more evocative than in the Exodus, where food becomes a symbol of the entire experience. And that experience is really the beginning of the Jewish people. To me, it's a symbol of how important food was as an icon, but also as an essential part of any Jewish experience.
At the beginning of your answer, you mentioned the apple.
Yeah.
We should say that in this book, each food has, let's say, an advocate.
Yes. Or a devil's advocate.
Exactly. Somebody who tells a story about that food. And the apple was given to Dan Barber, and he wrote something from the point of view of the apple itself.
Yes, that's the only entry written from the point of view of the food.
It's so great. So tell us a bit about what the apple says.
Well, the apple, as Dan manifests it, explains to human beings what it might have felt like to be at the center of this guilt-inducing first drama of human beings. But then as it emerges throughout Jewish history and also the history then ultimately of this country, where, as Dan puts it beautifully, I've become as American as apple pie.
And that's one of the things that I really love about so many of these entries, is that the food is not only discussed from an emotional, personal point of view, but also from a metaphorical point of view. And there is a lot of humor. So I'm just going to throw out some of the entries. So Wayne Hoffman wrote about Kichel,
mm-hmm.
and he calls it a cross between a bow tie and a fossil. It's the best.
Right.
A lot of people probably have no idea what Kichel is. Share with us what it is and how it was most used.
It's a cookie. It's used and was used primarily in Kiddush on Shabbat, on Sabbath, and primarily in synagogues or in other prayer spaces.
The next entry after Kichel is actually one that you took on yourself, Kiddush cookies.
Yes. The Kiddush cookies entry is really important to me because in it I told the story of a rabbi who explained to me that in the synagogue that he grew up in, his mother was a member of a group of women who would bake the cookies for the Kiddush after synagogue every Saturday. And at one point, some dumb management company came in to try to tell them where to cut corners and save money. And the first thing that they said was, what do we need a budget for women to cook cookies for? So they found some cheaper, faster, more efficient way to do it, which was to buy the cookies from some local bakery. But as the rabbi explained to me, of course, what this did was it took out of the hands of actual synagogue members the capacity to literally build that experience and to create that experience for themselves and also for their relatives. And it's a big divergence for that community and I think for all of American Jewry, because when we make and touch and eat the things that are supposed to have meaning, it's a holistic experience.
And the way the book is organized, with every entry having a little postage stamp size picture of the food in question, the pictures are incredibly evocative because you look at them like Kiddush cookies and you immediately recognize these cookies from bakeries where, you know, you buy them by the pound, the kind that
right.
are piped out of a pastry bag and then dipped in sprinkles, or a sandwich cookie with a little eye of jam showing through.
Yeah, the pictures, which were done by NoFX, that was one of the most fun 2 days of my life because we shot all of them together. So we had to sort of, as an army, fan out across New York and either buy or make every single one of these foods in the same 2 day period.
That's unbelievable. So one of my favorite entries is from Ruth Reichel, and it's lamb, but then in parentheses, not the leg and definitely not roasted.
Yeah, I don't want to give too much away because the story is so good. But suffice to say, what I love about that story is that Ruth, who should not really be lectured to about food by anyone, found herself in a situation when covering Jewish food of being schooled by Jewish readers in a what I think is a really funny and actually also poignant anecdote.
Yeah, it's wonderful. So let's talk about, I don't know how to pronounce it. It's one of Liel Leibovitz's entries,
mm-hmm.
and it's
mm-hmm.
pekela.
Yeah.
He refers to pekela as the hipster Jewish dream food, the greatest authentic dish you've never heard of.
I can't stand pekela. And maybe that means I'm not a hipster or not properly Jewish or something. But what I really love about that entry and what I love about a lot of the entries is that they do make full-throated arguments for their foods. And it's been really fun to find audiences and people and readers who so sharply disagree with them And that includes me.
It's so interesting because if you describe what pakela is, long cooked lamb, big white beans, what else is in there?
There's some greens.
Oh, yes, spinach that are cooked before they go into the braise.
Right.
So it's a mishmash. It's kind of like a cholent, right?
It's kind of like a cholent, but it's not. It was developed differently. And people who love pakela swear by it, including Liel. I think Liel has said to me at times that he would eat it every day. Part of the philosophical mission of the book was to understand that Jewish food is a cuisine that emerged out of very, very specific boundaries and strictures. And the primary boundaries are the prohibition against mixing meat and milk, the prohibition against cooking on the Sabbath or holidays, and the prohibition against eating leavened bread on Passover. And a lot of the dishes are dishes that emerged out of the creativity that Jews, primarily women, brought to those challenges. And cholent is obviously one of the iconic examples of that because it's a dish that emerged because Jews needed to put something on a stove and let it cook for many, many hours and still be edible. Because of that, it really is it's a symbol even more than it is a dish, although it's a dish too.
It's a dish of ingredients that meld well after a very long cooking.
Yes. And depending on what region you are from, your ingredients will be different. But the basics are going to be beans and meat. And with most European cholents also have potatoes in them.
So one of my favorite entries is leftovers.
Yeah.
And you have that marvelous Calvin Trillin quote.
Yes.
The most remarkable thing about my mother is that for 30 years, she served the family nothing but leftovers. The original meal has never been found. I kind of feel like that's the way I cook, that one thing leads into another, and I very rarely start from scratch.
The leftovers entry is one of those entries where, as one person said to me, when I first started reading it, I was laughing, and by the end, I had tears in my eyes. Of course, the idea of leftovers feels funny and feels like a lot of us can relate to it. It feels like maybe it was about our mothers or our fathers and their sense of wanting to save. But actually, what Alyssa Goldstein, the writer of that entry, does with it is she explains leftovers as existing inside of a Jewish conversation about abundance and about scarcity, and that both of those things are experiences that ribbon throughout Jewish experience. And we are anxious about both.
She calls it the terror of abundance.
I think it's the terror of abundance and the reality of scarcity. They're real and they're part of our history and they're part of our memory. And some people will even say they're part of our genetic code. I couldn't even conceive of the book without that entry now.
Yeah, it's perfect.
I have a recipe in there from my grandmother, which is for her hamenados, her slow-cooked eggs. And the hamenados are basically eggs cooked in whatever detritus was around your kitchen. That behavior is absolutely threaded throughout the book.
I'm about to make hamenados for 114 people. I use I use onion skins, but your grandmother used coffee grounds.
She did. Coffee, and also if she had a tea bag around, she would throw that in too.
Okay, so now we have to talk about tea bags. The thing that I remember growing up, that whenever I visited an older person's house, like people maybe a little older than my mother, there would always be a used tea bag on the counter near the stove in a little plate. If you were like an honored guest and you were being given tea, you would be given a fresh bag.
Well,
but,
wow.
But that used tea bag was like the family bag.
Right. The used tea bag is my favorite anecdote about putting together the list. When we were organizing to shoot the foods, we had to get all 100 foods in a studio on the same day. And so we had everybody from the tablet staff, plus a bunch of our volunteers and the photographer, the food stylist, and everybody had sort of fanned out and brought all these foods together. And we had this big Excel document where we would check off to make sure that each food was in, that it was prepared, that it was photographed, and so on. As we're sitting there, it was a November day, I went to go make myself a cup of tea. And I was sitting there with a cup of tea, and Stephanie Butnick, who worked on the book with me, is a deputy editor at Tablet, said to me, "Can I grab that tea bag from you?" And I said, "Of course." And then somebody else across the room said, "You know what? Can I have it next?" And all of a sudden, we all stared at each other and we said, "Oh my gosh, the used tea bag. That is the most Jewish food. What are we going to do?" Because we were all set. And then, like it was some sort of weird Hanukkah miracle, it turned out that we actually only had 99. So we were able to add in the used tea bag to the list, which is amazing.
Amazing. It wasn't kept and used over and over again because it was some fabulous, expensive tea bag.
No, it's because it could.
Yeah, Lipton.
Right. It could. And that was the point. The point was, why would you throw something away if it still had value?
Such a marvelous book. It's beautiful. And we should give a shout out to the illustrator who did lovely, adorable things throughout the book, Joanna Avalos.
Absolutely. Yes, she did some of the most hilarious and beautiful, insightful illustrations of Jewish food that I've ever seen.
Yeah, I like the challah hair the best.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Alana. It's really quite a marvelous book.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Alana Newhouse. We've been discussing her new book, The 100 Most Jewish Foods, a highly debatable list. That is it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. And as always, please leave us a review if you liked what you heard. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Abby Fentress-Swanson, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Kenny Ng and Laura Kondarajan. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.